Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, after 4 months of political limbo, is Germany's Grand Coalition set to renew its vows? Merkel and Macron shore up the European project in Davos. Allegations of spying on the Norwegian-Russian border. And
what's the difference between Milton Keynes and a pot of yogurt? The answer is the pot of yogurt has culture.
Will Brexit take Britain off the European cultural map? Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Germany's political deadlock is inching a bit closer to being resolved as the Social Democrats and Conservatives prepare to embark on highly controversial coalition talks. After the inconclusive September elections, the badly battered Social Democrats, or SPD, ruled out forming another grand coalition with Angela Merkel's CDU and its sister party, the CSU. But faced with the prospect of new elections, the SPD leader, Martin Schulz, did a U-turn in favour of coalition talks, which party delegates narrowly supported last weekend. So, what will be the main sticking points in these talks? Thomas Sparrow is DW's political and security correspondent.
I would say there are three key areas where the SPD would like improvements. First one, the family reunification for refugees. They are certainly not happy with that aspect of the preliminary agreement with the Conservatives. A second aspect, employment measures. And the third one, something also particularly important for the SPD, the healthcare system. So we're talking here about social justice issues that are very important for SPD voters.
Because of the resistance that SPD leaders faced at last weekend's party conference, they are, of course, hoping that the CDU and CSU will sweeten the coalition deal for them. What are the chances that the Conservatives will make concessions in talks?
Well, the main difference in this is the way that the Conservatives and Social Democrats view that preliminary agreement. The Social Democrats view it as a blueprint, as something that can be improved, whereas many Conservatives view that as a preliminary deal. In other words, something that can only be slightly changed. So that is indeed the big question. To what extent will the Social Democrats be able to change that preliminary agreement? Other Conservatives are rather sceptical about it and have said, well, we first have to see. But it is unclear to what extent we will want to change what we already agree on, because then we would have to open everything again for discussion.
And of course, the question is, where can the CDU and CSU make concessions without risking an uprising in their own parties?
That's correct. For example, in the area of refugees, that's something that the CSU in particular wanted. The CSU is the sister party of Angela Merkel's CDU, and they have been pressing for a long time for stricter measures on refugees, and in particular for a cap on the number of refugees arriving in Germany. So it's very likely that they won't change a lot there. What I think is likely is that they will probably change aspects within these topics to try and present it in a different way, both to the party members, the Social Democrats, and to the party members on the Conservative side. So I don't expect very big changes. I expect rather changes within these aspects that we've been talking about. In any case, the Social Democrats do have to go back to their delegates and to their members and say, look, this is what we managed to change, and this is what we're presenting to you. Because in the end, let's not forget, 440,000 SPD members, that's the entire membership of the party, will have to vote on whether to accept the coalition deal or whether that is not enough for them. That is probably the biggest hurdle that Conservatives and Social Democrats still have ahead of them.
Well, a new poll conducted a day after the SPD party conference saw support for the Social Democrats dropping to a new post-war low of just 17%. Do you think a new grand coalition could destroy one of Germany's oldest political parties?
I wouldn't go that far, although it's something that certainly has been mentioned. The SPD, nevertheless, is a very important party in Germany, a traditional party in Germany, one that still represents a good part of Germany's population, of the voters here in Germany. So I don't expect the SPD to be destroyed if they do enter another grand coalition, but it can be the case that they are further weakened. And that is precisely the debate that we saw on Sunday in Bonn, how the SPD should be stronger, how that renewal of the party, as the party members have been describing it, should take place. Should it take place when inside a government where you can probably pass some of your own proposals, where you can probably try and influence policies? Or should you leave governing to other parties and try and renew the party from outside and try and get that profile again that they want? That is probably the big dilemma that the SPD not only faced on Sunday, but is still trying to face, where they can have that renewal, where that renewal should take place.
So who would benefit most from a new grand coalition?
Probably the Conservatives, at least that's the way it's being described. Angela Merkel and the Conservatives know the Social Democrats very well, know the limits of the Social Democrats very well. And that was also the last chance that Angela Merkel had to try and form a new stable government in Germany. Angela Merkel had previously tried to form a coalition without the Social Democrats. Angela Merkel's Conservatives had tried to form a coalition with the Greens and the Liberals. But as you might remember, those talks collapsed in November, and Angela Merkel was left with just one chance to get another coalition in place, and that chance was with the Social Democrats. If this doesn't work, then Germany will be faced with two very big and very controversial options. One option would be a minority government led by Angela Merkel, something that she certainly doesn't favour. The second option would be fresh elections, something that even seems worse for Angela Merkel and even for the Social Democrats as well. New elections is something that basically no politician in Germany would like. So for Angela Merkel, it is certainly very good. And I think, although she wasn't in Bonn on Sunday, she certainly felt relieved when she saw that vote in favour of those coalition talks between the SPD and the Conservatives.
And I was talking there to Thomas Sparrow, DW's political and security correspondent in Berlin. Well, Germany's post-election limbo also has ramifications on a European level. With Germany being a key member state of the EU and Chancellor Angela Merkel somewhat hamstrung these past 4 months, many important policy decisions regarding the bloc have been put on hold. But French President Emmanuel Macron has been quick to fill the vacuum with ambitious and controversial proposals for EU reform, including a joint Eurozone budget and finance minister. On Wednesday, the veteran Merkel and rookie Macron spoke at the annual World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. My colleague Andreas Becker was there, and I asked him how the two leaders compared.
Well, most of all, it was a difference in style. Merkel was her usual self, meek and utterly unspectacular, rational, analytical. She spoke in German throughout, only switched to one sentence in English when she stated this year's motto, creating a shared future in a fractured world. And she kept it very short, 20 minutes. Macron, on the other hand, he talked for 1 hour, half of it in English, the second half in French, and he cracked a joke to start it off. He was flamboyant, energetic, and had all the qualities of a showman, trying to capture his audience, and the audience reacted by applauding several times. And the English part was clearly directed. It was not a press conference. Neither of them were press conferences. They were talks in the forum. And so the English part was clearly directed to present Macron himself as a reformer and a visionary and a strong force in politics, and as the president of a country that is open for business and wants to attract the international investors that are present here in Davos. So Macron said this.
Ladies and gentlemen, my first message is that France is back. France is back at the core of Europe.
And the French part of his speech was more directed to the audience back home. There he was arguing more why all his reforms are necessary and why nobody should feel he is going too fast or too strong.
Well, Merkel's comments were also a long-awaited reply to Macron's reform proposals for the EU. Are they both on the same page, though, when it comes to EU reform?
Well, both Merkel and Macron, they stressed how important European cooperation was. They mentioned the big themes like migration, economic reforms, becoming more digital. And Macron said he was working very closely with Angela Merkel. And Angela Merkel, on the other hand, had this to say. She said, while the British decision to leave the EU has been regrettable, it gave the rest of Europe more courage to concentrate on the big tasks ahead. And the election of Emmanuel Macron brought an additional drive to the EU, and this will make us stronger.
Französischen Präsidenten Emmanuel Macron ist da noch mal zusätzlich Schwung in die Europäische Union gekommen und das wird uns stärken.
And so she mentioned many French-German initiatives in the digital economy, a cooperation in defense. She mentioned the common capital market and the banking union. And the intent was clearly to show France and Germany they are on the same page, they will power the European Union together. But from Merkel's side, one thing was missing. There were no details regarding a common budget for euro nations that sometimes Macron was pushing for. And she did not mention the eurobonds.
Well, indeed, Europe's had quite a bumpy ride this past year. Brexit is still dragging on. There's this rift between Eastern and Western European member states over the migrant crisis. So how is Europe being perceived at this year's summit? Is it seen as an ailing continent in crisis, or perhaps as a strong union with a prosperous future?
Well, I would say both. Merkel and Macron did their best to underline the prosperous part, the strong union. Both said a strong Europe was needed to balance the US and rising powers like China and India, but also to keep alive this European idea of a social market economy that combines market forces and business friendliness with the importance of social security for all. So this is the one side. But the other one, there's of course the Brexit, and there's Theresa May speaking one day after Merkel and Macron. And when it comes to migration, for example, other European prime ministers are here in Davos as well, those of Italy and Greece, for example, and they made it very clear that Europe had a long way to go when it comes to dealing with the refugee crisis, and it also has a long way to go when it comes to speaking with one voice.
What about the bigger picture? The theme of this year's summit is creating a shared future in a fractured world. Now, that almost sounds like a slogan directed against US President Donald Trump's America First.
It does, doesn't it? Huh?
So how do the delegates you've spoken to feel about Trump's participation in the summit this year?
Some didn't hide their contempt for Trump and his politics, and others showed their admiration. But in general, my impression was that most participants who hold high office or high positions, they try to stay diplomatic and not to voice their opinion too openly.
I mean, you've been covering the Davos summit for DW for some time now. Critics of Davos tend to say that it's just a big circus with few tangible results. Do you see any tangible results this year so far?
No. Tangible results in Davos are rare, I would say. If you don't count business deals behind closed doors and the occasional initiative for development projects, which are laudable. But the main attraction of the forum is you can meet many powerful people here in a short time, and that saves time and money. And for politicians, there's the additional benefit that they can meet other leaders without the pressure of having to hammer out a joint statement after. So it's more about exchange, it's more about debate, and that, after all, doesn't hurt, does it?
Indeed not. My colleague Andreas Becker speaking from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland there. I'm Helen Sinian-Bonn, and you're listening to Inside Europe. For the first time ever, Russian authorities have arrested and charged a Norwegian national with spying. 62-year-old Frode Barrik was apprehended in Moscow in December. And this week, a Moscow court denied his appeal to be released, pending further investigations and a possible trial. But as Lars Bevanger now reports, some believe he could be a pawn in a greater geopolitical game.
The FSB, Russia's security service, says Frode Berg has been involved in espionage against Russia and the country's navy. Russian media have quoted unnamed sources in the FSB as saying he was carrying documents with secret details about the Russian Northern Fleet when he was arrested.
Well, he's actually a former border guard up in the Norwegian-Russian common border. And through his work and also privately has had a lot of contacts in Russia, so he's been visiting Russia both privately and through his job for a number of years.
Brynjulf Risnes is Berg's lawyer in Norway, coordinating his defence, led by a Russian colleague in Moscow. He says his client had been asked by two Norwegian citizens to carry 3,000 euros to a friend in Russia who needed it urgently, and that Berg had found that unproblematic. FSB apprehended him as he was on his way to deliver that money.
The whole story is very strange, and Frode Berg himself is a very unlikely spy. I mean, if you would have a spying operation going in Russia, you absolutely wouldn't use a person like this. A lot of people are pointing to possible sort of political background here, because the relationship between Norway and Russia aren't really the best.
Norway and Russia share a 200 kilometres long border in the north, a border which Frode Berg worked at for many years. The two countries have long enjoyed close cooperation on trade, culture and even, to a certain extent, defence. The 2014 Russian annexation of Crimea and Russia's support for President Assad in Syria has radically changed that relationship.
Uten sammenligning for øvrig, så det jo russiske etterretningstjenester som...
That's the head of Norway's police security service, Benedikte Bjørland, telling Norway's state broadcaster NRK earlier this year that Russian security services now represent a top threat to the country's security. Earlier, Norway's then defence minister and now foreign minister, Ine Eriksen Søreide, said her country's relationship with Moscow would never be the same after Putin's annexation of Crimea. Brynjulf Risnes believes his espionage-charged client could be used as a pawn in a greater geopolitical game by a Kremlin keen to score points in what it sees as an ongoing battle against the West.
This is part of course, the overall political picture with the sanctions against Russia, and that Russia is sort of seeking up cases, even creating casings in order to hit back, so to say. I guess that the Russian position now is that the ones who are hurting these relations are the Western parts, and Norway is here a part of the overall sanction regime.
What are your client's chances of acquittal should his case come to court?
Well, they are quite slim, actually. We've been looking at a number of espionage cases, and there's been some 70 plus, as far as I remember, espionage cases brought against foreigners in Russia. And this is since the year 2000. And they've all ended up with convictions, without exception.
The FSB is expected to ask for a further 2 months' detention for Frode Berg during a court hearing planned for next week. Espionage investigations in Russia are known to last for a year or longer. If convicted, Frode Berg faces between 10 and 20 years in prison. Lars Bevanger, DW.
British cities are to be banned from participating in the European Capitals of Culture programme. It's one of the many unintended consequences of Brexit. The main point of this scheme, which is administered by the EU, is to designate every year a different European city whose cultural assets have been overlooked. The winning city then splashes out on cultural events and typically, as a result, enjoys a big influx of tourists and investment. Banning Britain from participation post-Brexit has caused consternation among the 5 UK cities who are competing for the title in 2023. Stephen Beard has been to one of them, the so-called new town of Milton Keynes, northwest of London.
This town is thriving economically, but it's not the most obvious candidate for the title of European Capital of Culture. It was built in the 1960s to relieve the overcrowding in London. Florence or Venice, it ain't.
You've never seen anywhere like it. Central Milton Keynes.
A rather jaunty TV commercial battling against the town's image as dull, bland and featureless, a sterile concrete dormitory. Its only real claim to fame, it has more roundabouts or traffic circles than anywhere else. Even the head of the local tourist organisation, Anne Lim, can't resist ruefully retelling an old joke.
What's the difference between Milton Keynes and a pot of yoghurt? The answer is the pot of yoghurt has culture.
So why would Milton Keynes even enter a competition to become a European Capital of Culture? That is obvious, says leader of the City Council, Pete Marland.
We think that it would have brought in upwards of £200 to £300 million in the period between now and 2023. It would have really boosted the economy.
Liverpool reckons that after it won the title in 2008, it made more than $1 billion thanks to the big increase in visitors, hotel bookings, restaurant profits and even inward investment. Marland is more than a little ticked off that British cities are now banned from even bidding for the title.
Am I allowed to say I'm pretty because I am. I'm really annoyed.
But can a British city really be considered a European capital of culture after Brexit? Tourism chief Anne Lim.
Hang on, you know, we are still part of Europe. We're leaving the European Union because of this decision on Brexit. But we are a European, we are part of Europe, we have relationships with Europe, we think in a European way.
Britain may be leaving the 60-year-old political organisation that grew into the EU, but, insists Pete Marland, that doesn't change the geography.
We are still going to be on the continent of Europe. Look at a map. You know, we're not drifting towards America, and we're not going down towards Africa. We will just look at a map. We are in Europe.
And he says, think again about Milton Keynes' reputation. In reality, this town has plenty of culture, European culture. Has this world-class orchestra, for example, and a very successful theatre. And in spite of all the concrete around here, the surrounding villages are steeped in history.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
The words of Amazing Grace were composed by a local clergyman. A local museum tells his story. And not far from the centre of Milton Keynes, there's a fascinating slice of more recent history, as told in many feature films and documentaries.
September 1939. As Britain declared war on Nazi Germany, an extraordinary ragtag army was being assembled at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire to fight a secret war.
The code breakers at Bletchley Park cracked Germany's Enigma code and, says local businessman John Cove, played a vital role in the defeat of Hitler.
Bletchley, which is part of Milton Keynes, was a place where essentially the war was won.
Which, he says, further underlines the city's credentials as a European capital of culture and, indeed, some argue, emphasises the debt that Europe owes to Britain. John Cove deplores the EU ban, but concedes the city has benefited from the resulting publicity.
There's opportunity for us to be shouting about ourselves, what's good about Milton Keynes, what's different, for people not only to come and visit, but to invest, to move here, to live here.
Apart from the arts, he says, the city provides a glimpse of the way ahead for urban living. It's a centre of technical innovation. This summer, it'll become the first European town to launch a public taxi service using self-driving cars. Some already call it Capital of the Future. Not a bad consolation title, but clearly many in this slighted city would dearly love to be called European Capital of Culture. Stephen Beard, DW, Milton Keynes.
Don't forget to drop us a line if you have any comments or queries. Our email address is europe@dw.com. Hope to hear from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn, Germany. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. In the next half hour, another crackdown by the Turkish government on voices of dissent. Should tourists be charged to visit France's historic cathedrals?
Nous pensons qu'il est nécessaire aujourd'hui en France de...
We think it's necessary nowadays in France to charge tourists for visiting some religious buildings, particularly cathedrals. Cathedrals, which belong to the state, are places of worship, but they are not just places of worship. They're also places of history. And it's right and proper that tourists' entrance fees can be used to maintain these heritage treasures.
From Italy, we'll get a taste of the future of food and have a trawl through food waste here in Germany. Stay tuned for those stories and more. A new front has opened in the Syrian civil war. Turkish forces have crossed the border into Syria to attack an enclave in the north of the country called Afrin, which is under the control of the Kurdish militia, the YPG. The offensive has sparked a new crisis between Turkey and the US-led coalition fighting against Islamic State in Syria. Kurdish forces have been key to rooting out IS there. Ankara's action highlights the complicated array of alliances in Syria. It's also led to a further crackdown in Turkey itself. Politicians, activists and journalists who have criticised Ankara's military operation have been arrested. Our Istanbul correspondent Dorian Jones is with me. Dorian, who exactly has been targeted in this crackdown and why?
Well, four prominent journalists were arrested in midnight raids. In one case, a door of the house was broken and they were taken away in front of their two small children. Along with that, we have seen the arrests of hundreds of people for posts that they have put up on social media. Among those that have been detained also are many party officials of the country's main pro-Kurdish party, the HDP, which is the only parliamentary party that is opposing this military operation into Afrin. So there does appear to be this very extensive crackdown on any form of dissent, particularly on social media. The government and president are very sensitive about social media because really that is one of the last main forms of access to independent, critical comments and reporting on the situation in Turkey, given that the mainstream media is broadly seen as being in the direct or indirect control of the president and his government. And in fact, the prime minister, Binali Yildirim, summoned mainstream journalists where he gave them a 15-point suggestions on how to cover the ongoing conflict. Now, that was seen and been condemned by the Paris-based Reporters Without Borders, saying that this is a decree for patriotic journalism.
Now, Turkey's offensive in northern Syria is driving another wedge between Ankara and its NATO allies. Can you explain why there's opposition to it in Turkey itself?
Well, it has to be said that in Turkey, broadly, there does appear to be very strong support within the country for this operation. And the president has been crisscrossing the country with addressing mass rallies, ratcheting up the national rhetoric, saying that this is about a battle for the future of the country. That Syrian Kurdish militia is called an extension of a Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which is fighting an insurgency for decades inside Turkey. The PKK is designated as an international terrorist organization, both by the European Union and the United States. And the president saying that this is a war against this terrorist organization under another name. And that does have struck a chord among many in the country. But where the president is really worried about is Turkey's large Kurdish minority. They account for about 20% of the population. He's worried that there could be some major reaction from them. And he will be remembering what happened in 2014 when there was a siege of the Syrian Kurdish city of Kobani by Islamic State. And there were mass protests all across the country by Kurds, accusing the government of being complicit in supporting the Islamic State in that siege. Those protests shook the government and the president. Over 50 people died, and it took a massive effort and him having to reach out to the Kurdish movement to quell those protests. What he's worried about is that this latest operation by Afrin could lead to a similar repeat of that unrest. And he's given a very clear message. He said, any dissent will be crushed in Turkey.
In recent weeks, we've seen an improvement in relations between Turkey and Europe. In fact, President Erdogan seemed to be on a bit of a charm offensive. But this military campaign and the crackdown in Turkey has presumably put the brakes on that rapprochement.
Well, most definitely. You're right that the beginning of the year, you saw the president reaching out, visiting Greece, and then having a very high-profile visit in Paris with the French president. And this was seen as an attempt to reset relations. But to be honest, the message has been coming from Europe, even from Paris, who is the French president is considered to be a potential ally of the Turkish president. His message was clear that Turkey's bid to join the European Union is over because he said of choices that Turkey have made. And I think that going forward this year, there is expected to be some kind of showdown over defining and possibly ending Turkey's accession. What will follow that after that is unclear, because at the end of the day, Europe and the European Union does need to cooperate with Turkey. Turkey is a very important trading partner, but beyond that, they need Turkey to cooperate over the controlling of migration into the European Union and also security. Turkey, in many ways, is the gatekeeper to potentially hundreds of European jihadists linked to the Islamic State, possibly seeking to return back to Europe. Turkey is seen as very important in controlling that and preventing that.
But, I mean, there's been criticism that Western governments haven't been vocal enough in condemning Ankara's latest actions. Do you think the government there is feeling any heat at all over this?
Well, I think that the government, for now at least, are quite relieved that the pressure that they are facing from Europe is pretty muted now. There was this pushback from France initially, but now France appears to have fallen into line. And I think that for now at least, that Ankara does believe that it can carry on with this operation. I think that they do realize that there may be a limited time period, particularly if mounting concerns over the plight of the nearly million or so civilians living in this Afrin enclave, many of them nearly half a million in the city of Afrin. If Turkey's operation comes to that city and results in many numbers of civilian deaths, Turkey is aware that pressure will be building up. But publicly from the president, he says he doesn't care what the international community says. This is about the future of Turkey, and he's not prepared to back down. Behind the scenes, I think, though, the message from Europe will be you've got to end this operation soon, and you've got to limit the scope to that. Whether Turkey is prepared to listen to that remains to be seen.
And that was our Turkey correspondent Dorian Jones there, speaking from Istanbul. It costs the equivalent of 24 euros to get into London's Westminster Abbey and 18 euros to visit the cathedral in Seville. But go to Notre Dame in Paris and there's no entrance charge, even though the cathedral is in a dismal state of disrepair. The man President Emmanuel Macron has appointed to save France's crumbling heritage says he wants to change that. But the church is against entrance fees. John Lawrenson has more from Paris.
This is part of the cathedral that have been stocked here.
50 metres long, under awnings. It's got lots and lots of stones, which all comes from the cathedral?
All from the cathedral. So either they've fallen down or they've been taken off the cathedral because there was a big risk
that they would
for
fall.
Them to fall.
Round the back of Notre Dame Cathedral, a side that the tourists don't get to visit, with Michel Picot, the layman in charge of Friends of Notre Dame de Paris, which has just launched a big fundraising drive, trying to persuade rich Americans in particular to help renovate it. Don't be fooled by the glorious, recently restored facade. Notre Dame, possibly the most famous cathedral in the world, is in a disastrous state of disrepair.
You have a gargoyle?
It's a griffin. The head's
griffin,
no longer there.
The head is missing.
Taking a tour of the decrepit parts of the cathedral, whose construction began in the 1100s, is a long, breathtaking and dispiriting experience. Water is seeping through the roof, threatening the beams that hold it up. Some of the flying buttresses, another distinctive feature of this flower of the Gothic, are well on the way to collapse. Much of the relief work that adorns the cathedral has been worn away by acid rain, and where there should be gargoyles, there are often bits of plastic piping sticking out inside.
The flying buttress is partly falling.
This is all just hanging on, isn't it?
Exactly.
Mr. Pico is hoping to raise 2 million euros a year over the next 10 years, in which case the Ministry of Culture has agreed to double its contribution from 2 to 4 million a year. But some now say a radical long-term renovation funding solution is needed, and not only for Notre Dame.
Bonjour, monsieur. Bonjour.
Édouard de Lamaz is the president of the Religious Heritage Observatory, whose mission is to save those of France's close to 120,000 churches and other religious monuments that risk becoming ruins. It was this association that gave France's new heritage supremo, Stéphane Bern, the idea to push to make people pay to get into some churches, as is already the case in Spain, for example, or the UK.
Nous pensons qu'il est nécessaire aujourd'hui en France de faire payer la visite touristique.
We think it's necessary nowadays in France to charge tourists for visiting some religious buildings, particularly cathedrals. Cathedrals, which belong to the state, are places of worship, but they are not just places of worship. They're also places of history. And it's right and proper that tourists' entrance fees can be used to maintain these heritage treasures. And perhaps we could apply the same principle to some churches. I'm the mayor of a country village, and therefore I'm in charge of finding the money to pay for repairs to our beautiful early 18th century church. Mass is only celebrated there twice a year. But with paid visits, people could be guided around the marvels of this church, and we could repair a stained glass window, repaint the nave, and replace some of the pews.
France's 1905 law on the separation of church and state made all religious edifices built up to that date government property. Central government for the cathedrals, local for the churches. But in confiscating church property, the state also confiscated the responsibility of maintaining it. Now that burden is too much for some, or they have other priorities. Mr. de Lamaz cites the case of one local authority that recently refused to pay for church repairs and spent the money on a new roundabout instead. But the 1905 law also limits what the state can do with its churches. Access, for example, has to be free and permanent. So wouldn't entrance charges be simply illegal? Not necessarily, says Mr. de Lamaz, who is by profession a lawyer, as long as there's no charge for attending Mass. The Conference of French Bishops has, however, rejected the idea, saying paid access is inimical to the proposition of faith and the meeting with God. In the splendid 15th century church of Nogent-le-Roi, west of Paris, one of the fast-rising number of churches run by the community of St. Martin, a seminarist and priest sing Alma Redemptoris Mater, Loving Mother of Our Saviour. The priest's name is Father Enguerrand de Lorgerille. The church roof leaks, he tells me, and the bell tower has become so rickety they've had to take the bells down and replace them with a recording. But no way would they charge people to come in to pay for repairs. For one thing, he says, so many people have been touched by grace when they wandered, as if by accident, into a church, something they may not have done had they been required to pay.
Our poet, Paul Claudel, once entered the Cathedral Notre-Dame de Paris. He was an atheist, and he entered during the Vespers one afternoon. I think there is still a plaque in the exact place where he was like struck by grace. He was converted by the beauty of the worship. People were singing and praying in this church, and it became for him like so simple to believe. And in my personal experience, once I entered to just go to the sacristy and pick up something I needed for my services, and a woman was praying and came, and she just told me, look, it's unbelievable because I have very tough problems in my life, and I was just praying and asking the Lord, if you hear me, please make that priest enter the church now. And at this precise minute, I entered the church. And afterwards, I had beautiful exchanges with these people. And I think we can say it was a true grace for her. Some things have changed in her life since this providential encounter in our church.
Back at Notre Dame, I get talking to some of the 13 million people who visit this cathedral every year as they queue to get in. Some are pleasantly surprised when I tell them it's free, and some have an idea of a compromise.
If it's symbolic, like 1 euro, 2 euros, I think it's fine and it's necessary, yeah. Mm.
If it's more?
It's more, it pushes people away, yeah.
And you think it's important that people come here?
Yeah, I do. It's history, yeah, it's cultural.
Stefan Bern, Mr. Heritage as they call him here, the man who floated the entrance charge idea, will publish his report containing his final proposal on the matter in January. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
We head next to Italy, where late last year the world's largest agri-food park opened near the city of Bologna. It's called FICO Italy World and is dedicated to Italian food culture. The park features six so-called carousels, which are museum-style interactive installations explaining various aspects of man's relationship with food. Hortus is the carousel dedicated to food of the future. Dwindling water supplies and sprawling urban areas are creating increasing challenges for agriculture as we know it. So the installation offers visitors a vision of how hydroponic soil-free cultivation could be combined with mobile phone technology. Danny Mitzman has been finding out more from its creators.
To start this, you can pick one of those rock wool coupes that is like a basic model that you can use in hydroponic cultivation.
It feels like sponge.
Exactly. This is used in construction, but it can also be used in hydroponic cultivation. It's very safe.
Daniele Belleri works for the design office behind Man and the Future, Hortus, the installation here at Bologna's new agri-food park. He's showing me how urbanites might grow their own food in the future.
If we imagine that right now many people are already very interested in the origin of their own food from farm to fork, right? So if you push the boundary of the principles, maybe in 10, 20 years, there will be some supermarkets in which some areas will be dedicated to growing food. So I will take care of my plant, I will plant a seed, and through a web app, you can follow the growth of your own plant. And in that meantime, I will receive some notifications on my mobile phone so I can get updates on the status of the plant. So I can become a food producer, I can sow the seed, and then through time, I can get notification when there are the next steps of the growth of the plant.
And do I get photos as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's like a camera that is moving on the top of the hydroponic vegetable garden above it, and it's taking pictures of all the plants. And then you get those pictures of your plant on a mobile phone.
For many years, hydroponics or soil-free cultivation has been popular in greenhouses in Holland, the US and Russia, as well as in countries like Morocco, where water supplies are scarce. But could it be a solution in tomorrow's concrete jungles? And could a simple mobile phone app turn inner-city dwellers into active farmers? Daniele and his colleagues show me how it works at their pavilion.
So each person can take this piece of spongy rock and then can move across the pavilion where we have selected four kind of seeds. So we have, for example, two kind of lettuce, rocket, and we have basil. You take one single seed and like put into the rock wool unit.
We've chosen a curly lettuce seed. Is that what a curly lettuce seed looks like? Because it looks like it's sugar-coated almost.
Yeah, it's a particular kind of seed because that can allow the seed to have a higher possibility of like giving life to a plant, which is almost 100%. And we have to plant one of our model with the seed in one of the holes that there is on the ground so that the lower part of the model will be immersed into water. Well, actually, it's not exactly water. It's like water with some particular nutrients. That is one of the specific of the hydroponic cultivation, once again.
Power water.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so it's in its magic rock wool, the magic coated seed in magical water. And we've put ours
with
in...
With magical lights.
With magic... Ah, we have special lights as well. Okay, tell me about the lights.
Well, the lights are very interesting because they make the situation in the pavilion as if every day is the 21st of May, like a sunny day in spring in Italy. And so that's like the optimal condition for these plants to grow. And so our consultant, hydroponic consultants, has decided that this light has to be a particular tone. And so it's always spring in our pavilion.
The consultant in question is hydroponics expert Paolo Battistel, who spent the past 40 years perfecting his soilless cultivation techniques.
We have used the LED lights, LED lights. There is a mix of red and blue lamps because they are the colors absorbed by plants. The red is absorbed by plants to do the photosynthesis, And the blue is necessary for the so-called photomorphogenesis. It means the plant is able to produce the organs, leaves, flowers in the right way. Without the blue waves, the plant will become crazy.
Does the cycle that the plants go through reflect the natural cycle of a plant?
It is faster because we use an high intensity of light. And of course, we had to calculate also the installation for the fair.
The accelerated process would naturally take almost twice as long. In spite of this, Daniele believes it can make people feel closer to nature.
Even if you live in the city, thanks to this kind of system of cultivation, you can become more aware of the time of nature. So technology is allowing you to understand that nature has its own times, and you have to wait maybe for some weeks before your plant is ready. And you can also imagine that this can become like a future of retail somehow.
Well, maybe Daniele can, but I'm finding it pretty hard. Meanwhile, Paolo Battistel's keen to point out the eco-friendly aspect.
We can save water because here everything is recycled. In theory, we can use only 1 liter of water per 1 kilo of lettuce. In the open field, we use more than 100 liters per 1 kilo, so we save a lot of water. All the minerals are also recycled, so we don't have any pollution. The only bottleneck of this system is the high cost for electricity, so we have to work to solve this problem. But when we solve that problem, for sure it is the crop system of the future.
Paolo Battistel may be enthusiastic, but I can't help hoping we'll still be digging our potatoes up from the soil and picking our strawberries in fields. That said, if your children think salad comes from plastic bags, the Hortus Project may already be worth recommending to your local supermarket. Danny Mitzman, DW Radio, Bologna.
And still to come, we're going to delve into food waste here in Germany and find out why it's good enough to eat. I'm Helen Sinian-Bonn and you're listening to Inside Europe. Shriveled lemons, forgotten leftovers, and wilted celery are often found lurking at the back of fridges. In the EU, these abandoned groceries contribute to 88 million tons of annual food waste. Here in Germany, the average person throws away 82 kilograms of unused food every year. But a few enterprising individuals are trying to tackle this ethical, economic, and environmental dilemma. Our reporter Maggie Morris went to Cologne to find out more.
Nestled among Cologne's trendy boutiques, colourful street art and hip cafes in Ehrenfeld is an unassuming storefront. Its white narrow facade hides baskets overflowing with misshapen vegetables, shelves full of expired biscuits and tubs of leftover bread. The shop is called The Good Food. It stocks and sells salvaged food waste, and it's the first of its kind in Germany. It's Thursday afternoon, and the store is lively. It's a hype of activity here. Curious passers-by hover over a delivery of leftovers, while regulars form a beeline for the fridge out back.
Obviously, they're hungry.
Finally, once the rush is over, it's quiet enough to chat to store owner Nicole Klusky. Inspired by her work with a local NGO in Nepal, it dawned on Klusky just how wasteful people are back home in Germany.
There I learned how people live without all the resources we waste over here. So when I returned back home, I realized over here we waste so much food. So I thought I have to do something against that.
In Germany alone, some 11 million tons of food are thrown away by households, grocery stores, restaurants, and hotels every year. That's more than 80 kilos per person. And it doesn't even account for wasted food from farms, says Klusky.
At the farmers, there's lots of food loss happening. It's not really a waste because the farmer obviously loves his product and he loves the work he puts into it. You know, he goes out to the fields, he harvests it, and then he has really complicated contracts with our shops here. So there are lots of rules he has to obey. A potato has to be a certain size, otherwise the shop won't buy it. So it's a really absurd contract he has to fulfill. Otherwise, he won't get rid of his tomatoes and potatoes and all the vegetables.
Kosky decided to salvage the perfectly tasty produce that farmers simply can't sell. So every week, she and a team of about 20 people visit a handful of farms in the Cologne area.
Then we come back to our shop, bring all the fresh vegetables here, and here you can buy them, but you pay whatever you like to pay. So you pay whatever it's worth to you. So by that, we would like you to think about what is something worth to me that otherwise would have been thrown out or would have gone to waste. And that way we carry this topic of food waste out into the world and we try to make it public that so much food waste is happening.
That's from gestern. Catering gestern
and Kosky hasn't just partnered with farmers. She works with local bakers, breweries and cafes, stocking her shelves with lemonade, beer, cakes and
chocolate. Today we've just got really huge amount of chocolate, like 3,000 pieces of chocolate, because it's run out of date. It's not bad, the product. It's still really tasty. We've just tested them all and they are very, very nice.
Yeah.
It smells really nice, doesn't it?
Although all of the packaged products are technically out of date, Kosky says they're perfectly fine to eat.
So we have seasonal and regional products, and with our use-by date, we have little signs throughout the whole shop saying abgelaufen, aber lecker, which means it's overdue but still tasty. And that way we inform our people and our customers and they know where they are at. And of course, that's what we want to do. We want to tell them, you know, the use-by date has run out and the product is still tasty.
We actually have carrots and potatoes here as well.
For the business and farm owners that Kosky works with, the benefits of their partnership are wide-ranging. Mo Shams, who owns Homage Coffee Bar, says ethics, economics and simple logistics all played a role in his decision to team up with the good food.
First of all, I think it's really disrespectful against the people who don't have food. Second, it's also really good because you save a lot of money. And we are in the inner heart of Cologne and the streets are small and we don't have big bins in our streets.
The Good Food Store is part of a growing collection of small initiatives tackling food waste from the ground up.
It's from the supermarkets, it's from producer, it's from everywhere, from restaurants. Every person has their own food waste problem.
That's Peter Wiedeking, who works for Too Good To Go, a new startup that sells restaurant leftovers for 2 to 4 euros. He says dealing with food waste starts with a profitable plan that satisfies both consumer and producer.
It's only a very small part of the whole food waste problem in the world, but I think Too Good To Go has a very good solution for it because we have a business model for it. You know, the restaurants, the cafes, they get a little bit money for their effort to reduce food waste, and the customer, they get better value for their effort to reduce food waste.
Maggie Morris, DW, Cologne.
And that wraps up this edition of the show. Hope you enjoyed it. It was produced with help from Neil King and sound engineer Jürgen Kuhn. And I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. We'll be back at the same time next week. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.